listening to Turning Hard Times into Good Times with your host, Jay Taylor. If you have a question or comment about today's show, Jay would love to hear from you at 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. You can also send an email to questionsfortaylor@gmail.com. That's questions, the number 4, taylor@gmail.com. Now, back to our program.
Welcome back to Turning Hard Times into Good Times. I'm your host, Jay Taylor, and I'm really pleased to have Richard Mayberry with me once again. Richard is the publisher of U.S. World Early Warning Report, but he's written several entry-level common sense books that are really, I think, essential. I mean, I wish these books were taught in the public schools instead of the garbage that's being taught these days, but a lot of very practical books and based on the founding principles of our country to a great extent really help. Anybody that would read these books, and they're simple, easy to read books, would have an understanding far greater than what our kids are being taught in school about the reasons we have a republic and not a democracy, why it was a democratic republic and not a democracy, and how, if you want to have prosperity, how the free markets work best. Rick does an awful lot of very valuable information in those books. Some of them are, well, Whatever Happened to Penny Candy is one of my favorites. Anyway, I just would like to suggest that you all go to Rick's website, and that would be to earlywarningreport.com, earlywarningreport.com. I think you can order those books there, but you can also subscribe to his newsletter, which I strongly suggest you consider doing. Rick, thanks for joining us again.
Oh, thank you, Jay. I always enjoy talking with you. You're doing such a great job of providing people a viewpoint different than the nonsense that's put out by the mainstream press. And thank you very much. My wife and I are grateful to have you there. Thank you.
Well, we're likewise with you, and it's not that that I'm doing anything new. I mean, I'm just taking a playbook from our founding fathers to a great extent, as I know you are. And those values, I think, are really what has made us a great country, a free and a country of liberty and freedom. And we tried our best in terms of justice for all as well. And I think we were getting better for a while. But in any event, let's get on to today's topic, Rick. And I really wanted to talk to you a lot about, or you talk to us, I should say, about October-November newsletter. Your early warning report. And to start out with, I mean, you started out by saying you noted that something mighty big and unprecedented is taking shape, namely the growth of the amount of money that if circulating in the that is circulating in the global economy. And you quoted an economist in noting that it took thousands of years for the global money supply to go up to 18 trillion, which is an amount that's hard to imagine, but it's taken only 20 months beyond that to add another $11 trillion to the total money supply globally. Can you perhaps talk about some of the ramifications of the to the global economy and to society in general, and maybe also who benefits from this money creation and who is hurt by it?
Well, one of the benefits is people are going to be forced. They are actually being forced to consider other means of storing value. You know, that's the main purpose of a currency, is to store value until you want to use it to trade for something. And I think that one of the main benefits is that people are now going to be forced to consider things that they never would have thought of before, like, for instance, the precious metals, gold and silver. And I like platinum, too. My favorite right now, my favorite buy is platinum. Yeah. And I think, you know, that's going to be a wonderful thing. People are going to rediscover what real money is simply because they're going to be forced to rediscover it. I think that's going to be very good. Now, as far as political ramifications, I as you and I were talking before we were on the air, I think that what happened in Cuba during the Cuban Revolution around 1959, I think it was.
Right.
I think that is a model for what's going to happen in the United States. Now, what happened in Cuba is that the Cuban government was crooked as a dog's hind leg. That should ring a bell here for people.
Absolutely.
And And it was stealing everything it could get its hands on. Very corrupt, you know, hugely corrupt. That was the government of Batista, the leader. And the official history that everybody is taught is that Castro was leading a communist revolution to take over Cuba, and finally they got enough power to actually be able to throw out Batista and take over and make Cuba communist. Well, it could be that Castro was actually a real communist, I don't know, or socialist, whichever term you want to use. But I used to know, long ago, I knew a professor of Latin American history who said that official story is ridiculous. It simply did not happen. And what really happened was the population was getting more and more angry, and all over the country, rebellions were breaking out. Just independent groups of rebels were arming themselves and fighting against the Batista army. So you had not just Castro's group, but there were probably dozens of other groups out there in the jungle and the open country that were operating, trying to get some of their freedom back. And eventually, the Batista government in Havana realized that the jig was up, and that, you know, they better get out of the country or they were going to wind up hanging from lampposts. So one day, all the leaders just packed onto an airplane and took off and just flew away. And the presidential palace in Havana was empty. And word got around across the island that the presidential palace was empty. The government had just run away. And then the leaders of all of these different guerrilla groups all over Cuba they jumped in their jeeps and they started driving toward Havana. And the way Castro took over is simply that he had the fastest jeep. And he got there first and declared a communist republic. And that's how it really happened. It was just totally accidental that he happened to get there first.
Well, I guess that's important then. If the same sort of thing plays out in the U.S., who gets there first is very important.
Exactly, and that's my point. I think America is coming to that stage where the population, or at least probably more than half of it, will be so angry at the federal government that the politicians and top bureaucrats in Washington are simply one day going to walk away. They're going to get in their cars and just disappear. And suddenly all those buildings, those government buildings in Washington, are going to be empty, and the word is going to get around that there's no government left up there. They all just left. And I think that, well, what will happen is there'll be a race to get there, and whoever gets there first is going to wind up being the head of the new U.S. government, whatever that happens to be. It'll be just like Cuba. And so, you know, that's kind of my expectation, is that at some point the economy is going to get so bad that the government's just going to pack its bags and leave.
So do you think it will be primarily an economic problem that angers people? We're hearing a lot of other issues besides economics. I mean, certainly inflation is on the rise now, but we're also hearing people very angry about what's going on in the public schools. You know, there's a lot of reasons to be upset and looking at what's happening politically and how the COVID virus thing has been politicized to a great extent and used by government to basically take our liberties and our freedoms away and tell us how to live and what to think. And don't you dare have another professional medical opinion that is opposite that of the Biden administration, or you get silenced and taken off the YouTube and whatever else. So what do you think it would, will it be economics primarily, because right now we're seeing what the CPI at 5-something percent, I think, is the latest number. It's really rising fairly dramatically, I think. So you think it will be economics that primarily upsets the apple cart?
That's what it usually is. You never know for sure until it actually happens. But in most cases, when you look down through history all around the world, it's economics that trigger off the rebellion. People want to have some financial security. They want to know they can take care of their kids. And, their families are the very most important thing to them. And when they begin to realize, and this is what's coming, I think, people are going to begin to realize that the government is a threat to their families.
Mm-hmm.
And boy, when that dawns on the population, look out. And what I focus on actually is the Marines.
Mm-hmm.
The Marines are the palace guard of the federal government. And the day will come, I think, maybe not too long, I don't know, when politicians are just going to leave, the top bureaucrats are going to leave, and the Marines are going to be standing there. They're the guys that guard the buildings. They're going to be standing there and wondering what to do.
Mm-hmm.
And whoever shows up that they believe in mm-hmm. is going to be president.
Mm-hmm.
If you want to keep an eye on what's going on in the country, really be sure you're watching the Marines.
Well, this is a very good, a very interesting point, Rick, because the Biden administration is clearly trying to change the composition of its military leaders. And I noticed, I think, at the military academies, it's gotten rid of Trump appointees and are putting in the people of their like mind of a liberal variety, I believe. And so I guess that's something we need to be watching. I mean, it certainly seems important.
Yeah. At bottom, the people who really decide are the government. The people that have the last word in it are the trigger pullers.
Mm-hmm.
PFC Jones.
Mm-hmm.
PFC Jones is the guy who's actually going to enforce whatever new government exists, and so he's going to decide who he's willing to shoot and who he's not willing to shoot, and. Mm-hmm. So it's his attitudes, PFC Jones, mm-hmm. it's his attitudes that are going to determine what kind of government we're going to have.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, we've certainly seen the influence of the existing administration trying to put in people that will educate the PFC Jones and down the line so that they mm-hmm. think the way they want them to think, right? So the soldiers, when they – you were one. I never was in the military, but you – you swear to uphold the Constitution, right? It's not, or
yep.
Who are you obliged to, the Constitution or to your direct commander?
In most cases, it is a legal fact that mm-hmm. you are first and foremost supposed to follow the Constitution.
Mm-hmm.
But what that means generally in actual practice is do you trust your individual commander more than you trust the politicians? And
mm-hmm.
the answer is almost always yes.
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So the education, the educational, or the values that are implicit, or that are in the military, in the heads, and the minds, and the hearts of the military, is extremely mm-hmm. important. Then.
Oh, absolutely. It's the last word on the subject. That's
mm-hmm.
those are the people. In the end, they're going to make the final decision about who the government is. That happened back when the Constitution was created. The reason that George Washington, a military general, was picked to lead the Constitutional Convention was because everybody knew that the army had to be behind the Constitution or it wasn't going to
uh-huh.
survive.
Uh-huh.
That's why Washington was put in there.
Mm-hmm. Well, let me ask you this, Rick. If it's economics, it's inflation. Inflation is a great destabilizer of society, no question about it. For the common folks, for the masses, the people on top are doing quite well, and we've seen this massive redistribution of income through this printing press, money being created. It helps the rich get richer, and it And so we start to see people's salaries not going up as fast as the inflation, and they start having, if they have work at all. And so, and food prices is really a key. When food prices go up and people can't put food on their table, then, you know, what is there to lose but to rebel? So the Fed knows this stuff. The Fed, even though they don't give lip service to the money supply, as Milton Friedman did, that's the reason for inflation. The Fed understands that it is. And the Fed doesn't want to have disruptions, I wouldn't think. I think they would like to have things going hummingly well because they're doing extremely well. Why doesn't the Fed then put the brakes on the money supply? What's keeping it from doing that?
Well, that's the article in the October, November early warning report. I don't know. It's like four pages long, and it's a very, very careful explanation of what's going on here. And the key to the whole thing is what's called malinvestment.
Mm-hmm.
Malinvestment is investment made in the wrong places or the wrong times for the wrong reasons. And what happens is the Federal Reserve increases the money supply. They inject money into the economy, but it does not go into the economy in a uniform blanket. We don't all get equal shares of that money they inject into the economy. Some people get a whole lot, others get less, and some get none at all. And wherever you see a lot of money going into a given location, that becomes a hot spot. And businesses see that hotspot developing, and they move in there. They spend their capital, which is the savings of the people. They spend the capital building new factories and offices and buying new equipment, and all of this capital formation goes on in these hotspots that are artificially created by the Federal Reserve. So Once those hotspots exist, then the Federal Reserve has to keep pumping out money to keep them alive so that they don't go under and you don't have a huge wave of unemployment. So that's the Federal Reserve walked into that trap back in 1914 when they decided to finance the First World War and by printing money. And they created what's called the business cycle, the boom and bust cycle. And the boom is when they're injecting money and new businesses are being built, and the bust is when they stop injecting the money and those businesses start going under. They go in the red and they lay off their employees. And so we've been on this malarial, chill and fever
mm-hmm.
business cycle ever since the Fed was created in 1914. It keeps getting worse and worse, and that's where we are today. If they stop printing money, there is going to be a huge shakeout of all of this malinvestment.
Mm-hmm.
And now, what I explain in the newsletter, it's too complicated to get into here.
Yes.
Into right here, but we've got a model to follow there. The recession that occurred after World War II was handled correctly mm-hmm. by the government. It's one of the very few times in history where they did something right. And the correction period only lasted, maybe 1 year at the most, and everything came off just beautifully. Unemployment only got up to 5.9%. Typically, we bump up against 10% in the recessions today.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
But as bad as that shakeout had to be after World War II, it was actually so mild that most Americans don't know it happened.
Mm-hmm.
So, that's the model to follow. And as I said, it takes me like four pages to explain the whole thing.
But yeah.
I think it's one of the best explanations I've ever done.
Well, that's a good reason for people to subscribe to your letter and get a copy of that. That's the October-November issue. Normally you publish every month, but I guess there's a couple of months of the year where you combine two months, right? Is it 10 issues a year, Rich?
That's right.
Yeah. All right. So, you mentioned keep an eye on the Marines, but another thing that you keep an eye on in terms of inflation and the mood of the people is monetary velocity. You show it every month in your newsletter. And comment on monetary velocity, because it's very important as people start to get fearful, or they start to see prices rising, they start to hoard, or they start to realize that their money is becoming worth less, they say, well, let's buy it today because tomorrow it's going to cost a lot more. And then that sort of a self-feeding loop, isn't it?
Yes.
And where do we, what is your view right now of monetary velocity in the United States and globally?
I think it's still, I think in the United States it's still depressed, mm-hmm. and probably abroad. Now I'm talking about the velocity of the dollar only.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Abroad, it's even more depressed, mm-hmm. because people have been scared for who knows 20 years or something, and so you know, they're frightened and they've been hanging on to their dollars. But we are in a situation now where the Fed has gone absolutely nuts printing money, and people are catching on that money is going to lose a lot of its value. And so I think we're in a transition period here between low velocity and high velocity. And when you get to high velocity, people start buying stuff, you know, madly, mm-hmm. in order to get rid of the money as fast as possible before, as you say, it becomes worth less.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, I think we're heading up against that, where they will start spending the money like crazy. And the people that are selling things are going to realize, well, do I really want to take this money?
Yeah.
And do I want to accept it? And what they will do is they will raise their prices. And they will keep on raising those prices as fast as they possibly can, because mm-hmm. they actually don't want the money either.
Mm-hmm.
So they need extra money to take some of the risk out of making a sale. And so then that's velocity taking off. When these people start spending their money very quickly, and when the people who own the goods and services begin raising their prices quickly in order to make sure that they don't take a bath in these transactions, then you are in a position where the money's changing hands faster and faster and faster, and prices are rising faster and faster and faster, and that's what makes a runaway inflation, where mm-hmm. you eventually wind up with, if the Fed doesn't stop printing money, you're going to eventually wind up with prices rising dramatically mm-hmm. on a daily basis.
Mm-hmm.
And, we've seen this in history, dozens and dozens of times.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody, I think, has probably heard of Zimbabwe. That's the most recent one, where, it would take a million Zimbabwe dollars to buy a stick of gum.
Mm-hmm.
That's where you eventually wind
right.
up.
All right. Well, Rick, you, in your newsletter, you show stage one, stage two, stage three in this process of velocity. And you have mm-hmm. the United States, as you just said, a little bit more velocity there than globally. But you're mm-hmm. getting close in your newsletter to stage two. Might you quickly describe stage one, stage two, stage three? And again, folks, Rick keeps track of this every month in his letter. It's another bit of information I think is very valuable. But if you could, Rick, just quickly, the different stages. I guess stage one starts out kind of slowly, but
right.
then as things accelerate, it seems, I think.
Right. There's an article on our website that explains this a lot better than I will be able to hear
uh-huh.
very quickly. Inflations go through three stages. In the first stage, people really don't understand what's going on, and they don't know about the Federal Reserve printing money and making it less valuable. And they have this attitude of, well, I'll wait until tomorrow to buy such and such because maybe the price will come down.
Yeah.
Okay, so the money circulates slowly in stage one. Now, the Fed can actually print a lot of this stuff, which has been going on for the last 20 years or so. They can print a whole lot of it, and people just won't spend it very quickly,
uh-huh.
and so it doesn't affect prices very much.
Mm-hmm.
In stage two, they're catching on. They're beginning to realize there's some kind of fraud going on, and their money is losing value, and maybe they better spend it faster. And then, that's when you have the velocity starting to take off, because every dollar is circulating more quickly and can affect prices more easily because it's circulating so fast. So you have stage two, where the prices start really taking off, And I think we're in the beginning of that right now. Mm-hmm. We're out of stage one and very close to stage two, mm-hmm. probably. Mm-hmm. And then the third stage is one where they don't care what they're buying or what it costs. It doesn't matter. Just get rid of the money as mm-hmm. fast as possible. Mm-hmm. And that's the wheelbarrow stage where yeah. you actually see people going down the street with wheelbarrows full of money that they're trying to get rid of in some way before it becomes worthless.
Right. All right, Rick. Well, we're just about out of time, but I would just say that anybody that's seen a chart of the German hyperinflation will see a very long period of flat, stable prices and then gently rising. That would be stage two, and then all of a sudden stage three is a blow-off phase. And that can't last very long because all of society melts down, and that may be the kind of thing that you were talking about, Cuba, your Cuba model. That may be the time when things start to really one way or another, they have to settle down because people just can't live that way. Rick, with just a couple of minutes left here, you mentioned platinum. You mentioned also, I should tell people that in your newsletter, you provided some ideas for income because Lord knows we're going to need income when things go in the wrong direction. We always do need income. But I would like to ask you and maybe close out by asking you in terms of balance sheet, people that are, you know, that have more than they need right now, where should they be allocating their resources, their financial resources in preparation for what looks increasingly likely a serious inflation problem?
I never hesitate to say that everybody ought to have some gold, silver, and platinum coins.
Mm-hmm.
That's just a given because you know that's what's really going to be buying you your groceries mm-hmm. during an inflation. And then beyond that, you want the kind of investments that are able to rise in value as the money falls. And you know, one of the best examples is real estate, which has been doing exactly that.
Mm-hmm.
Real estate in the last 2 years or so has been performing exactly like it's supposed to mm-hmm. in inflation. Just, you know, the main thing to understand is that almost everything will rise because the money will fall.
Right.
And so you just do not want to have investments that are tied to the value of the dollar. The best example is bank accounts and bonds. Their value only comes from the value of the dollar. There's no other place. And if the dollar's fallen, then the value of those instruments is falling. And those instruments are fixed income, so they cannot adjust to an inflationary situation.
Mm-hmm.
Stocks, on the other hand, can. Mm-hmm. And, you know, in this newsletter, I recommended several stocks. Mainly, you want ones that sell the kinds of things that people have to have,
uh-huh.
regardless of how bad things are.
Mm-hmm.
Things like drugs and fuel and toilet paper and mm-hmm. gasoline, you know, these necessities. You want companies that produce those.
Right.
One of them that I like is Walgreens Boots Alliance.
Mm-hmm.
The symbol is WBA.
Mm-hmm.
And another one is Medical Properties Trust.
Mm-hmm.
And the symbol is MPW. These are the kinds of firms mm-hmm. that sell the things that people must have. And so I really recommend those.
All right, Rick, we'll have to leave it go at that. Thank you so much for sharing those ideas with us. It's always good to catch up with you. We should do it more often, no doubt, because you do. What I'd like just my listeners to know is that not only do you provide a rich understanding of history and apply it to the present time, but you also provide some practical ideas for people to help them with the financial needs that they have going forward. Rick, thank you so much for being with us. And again, folks, it's earlywarningreport.com, earlywarningreport.com to sign up for Rick's newsletter. It's a brilliant piece of work, and I definitely suggest you sign up for that. Thank you, Rick, for being with us, and we'll do it again sometime soon.
Thank you, Jay.
Yeah, all right, folks, we do have to go. That's it for this week. Next week, Alistair McLeod will be with me, Patrick Highsmith of Firefox Gold, and Michael Oliver of Oliver MSA. Until then, goodbye and God's blessings to you.
Thank you again for listening to Turning Hard Times into Good Times with Jay Taylor. Please join us again next Tuesday at noon Pacific Time, 3 p.m. Eastern Time on the Voice America Business Channel.
Labrador Gold is an exploration company focused on its flagship Kingsway project, located in central Newfoundland Gold District. Labrador Gold's first phase drilling program has successfully identified high-grade gold mineralization, including a 3.6-meter intercept, grading 20.6 grams per ton gold, and 1.85 meters, grading 50.38 gram per ton gold. The company has approximately $35 million in the treasury and is led by a world-class team of CEO Roger Moss and technical advisors Sean Ryan and Quentin Henney.